In the Moment on SDPB is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 20th through 22nd in Brookings.
We enter the Independence Day holiday weekend reconsidering tenets of American democracy. From SDPB, today is Wednesday, July 3rd. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, what does the Supreme Court decision mean for the future of presidential immunity? We get beyond the hype with SDSU political scientist Lisa Hager. Today's Summer with the Symphony send-off features a classic work by Mozart. The South Dakota Symphony Orchestra performs Mozart's Symphony No. 9. That's coming later in the hour. But first, who are the future leaders in American politics? Who are the governors serving states right now? Alexander Hefner sits down for a meal, including the All-American Ballpark hot dog, with political leaders. That's coming up after the news. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Alexander Hefner will spend a second season breaking bread and sharing a little recreation with America's political leaders and rising statesmen. Breaking Bread with Alexander returns tomorrow to Bloomberg TV. Hefner hosts The Open Mind on PBS. He is co-author of the book A Documentary History of the United States. I spoke with him last week.
Season two is launching, and you know, we had three different types of hot dogs. Sonoran bacon-wrapped hot dogs in Arizona with Senator Kelly, chili dogs with obviously chili onions, chopped onions in Kansas with Senator Moran, and the most interesting, crab-dipped hot dogs at Camden Yards with Governor Moore.
Oh, wow.
Your listeners might recall the premise of the series is that food can help humanize and produce a more healthy and functional politics, and that we use our meals with legislators, high-profile governors and senators, your Senator Thune, likely soon to be majority or minority leader of the Senate, was featured in season one after cheeseburgers and Murdo. We extended the activities for this season. So as I did with Senator Thune, played some hoops and had chow. In most of these 12 episodes, there is a meal. We try to extend that momentum of carrying forward our humanity through recreation with Governor Moore, an aspiring president himself in Maryland. Wes Moore and I went to an Orioles game at Camden Yards and had those crab-topped hot dogs. And I'm really excited about this season because when most Americans are depressed about the repeat of President Trump and President Biden, we are giving voice to charismatic, fresh perspectives from some of the people who ought to be leading this country.
Tell me a little bit about some of the people that maybe don't have a high national profile, but that are really thinking deeply about democracy and policy that goes beyond their state and to the nation.
I think it's safe to say every single guest in this season is thinking about democracy from that perspective. The examples of individual leaders who are championing voting rights, I think in particular, are Senator Kelly of Arizona and Senator Warnock of Georgia. When you think of the question of representing your constituents and understanding your role as a steward of civil society as much as the democratic order, I mean, I think each one of these individuals believes that decency informs and can animate a better deliberative process. That's a distinction between the duopolistic control of the Democratic and Republican Party at the highest levels that are about too much appeasing the egos of the nominees for president and justifying their being on the ballot when in fact there are these other people. who are doing innovative things in their states, who are liked and well regarded in their states. You know, there's that phenomenon we've talked about, Lori, of you being asked about your congressman, and you give him a high rating, but give the Congress as a whole a dismally low rating. Now, when you extrapolate that to the state level, there are a lot of popular governors in this country. I mean, if you look at the public opinion surveys and you hear anecdotes of people like Governor Healey of Massachusetts, Governor Gordon of Wyoming, who are engaging in, you know, public policy decision making at the highest level to provide for housing in an age when we've talked about a crisis, but it's become a status quo of unaffordability, and the pandemic exacerbated that everywhere, and made it a crisis in places that might not have been a crisis. So whether it was environmental stewardship or the economy, you know, each one of the guests of season two brings a diplomatic, forward-thinking approach that they don't singularly have the answer. And now both major candidates for president are making the argument essentially that they are what stands existentially between the civil society and democracy we hold dear and tyranny. I don't think that's effective messaging. I don't, that's not, you know, that's not what you hear from some of these popular governors who are doing innovative things with renewable energy, economic development in their states, across the whole geography of this country.
I want to ask you a little more about that to expand on that, if you will, because I remember the first time I talked to Kristi Noem when she was in Congress and Representative Noem was supporting Donald Trump as a candidate. You know, we talked about his character, which was in question at the time and remains so. And she said she didn't need him to be a role model. She needed him to sign conservative legislation. And after the most recent presidential debate that we're all still recovering from, you hear some of the Democrats saying the same thing, which is, you know, yes, this must be this might be a really disappointing candidate in Joe Biden, but the other side is going to, you know, ruin America. Alexander, we're not we're not supposed to have a puppet president that is just initiating a platform. We're supposed to have these three branches of government, not run by a party, not run by Congress. It's a check and balance against these things. Help me sort through what's happening and where we go from here as we look at this particular election and some of the narrative that is coming about the weaknesses of the candidate. Please overlook them for the power of the platform or the party.
Well said, Lori. You know, I just think about my one-on-one human experiences with the candidates and electeds who are running in season two. They just project a spirit about the tapestry of the country that they are one of us and we are one of them. And there is a demographic to which both of these major party candidates belong. And I want to resist at every opportunity sounding ageist. But, you know, when you go out to a farm in rural Wisconsin, as I did with Senator Baldwin, and have beers and cheese curd, she and I are touring, we're looking at the cows, making observations about the farm, and then going inside the cheese making plant, putting on shower caps and gowns and the whole nine yards. I mean, there's a reason that Senator Baldwin is running for re-election in Wisconsin and not someone of the age and temperament of a former President Trump or current President Biden. I mean, the people who wrote the Declaration and Constitution were young. I mean, the founding fathers and their wives, mothers were young. They were in their 30s on average. Some were in their 20s or 40s. But, you know, we've gotten away from that. President Clinton and then President Obama brought that back, you know, and it's incredibly disorienting to look at the technological world we live in and think that just because these gentlemen have X Twitter accounts and are doing crazy digital ads in the multi-millions in what will be another billion-dollar plus campaign, it doesn't make sense. And we drafted these documents, we speaking for our forefathers, bearers. The Madisonian ideal specifically was you bring a discipline or expertise of your work to the job and you serve the public and then you give someone else a shot at it. And, you know, whether that's the farmer or the newspaper man or the scientist, I would not know that I could break bread with either of these folks in their condition for different reasons, right? And so your question is spot on, and I think that, you know, the answer lies in finally enlisting people who ought to have been serving our country starting in 2016. I think Secretary Clinton is not quite at the stage of Donald Trump or Joe Biden, but even then, it was a deficit to the country not to have some of the emerging voices, the Sherrod Browns and the John Testers, who are older now. But this season of Breaking Bread really has it all. It has Senator Warnock of Georgia, Governor Moore of Maryland, and, you know, on the other side of the fence, Republicans, Senator Murkowski of Alaska, Governor Gordon of Wyoming. And I'll just add one last thing for us to maybe consider on July 4th. The essence of this series is that we are a union of states. And what I want people to remember is that there are tens, in fact, hundreds of thousands, and sometimes millions of voters in a state that we call blue or red who are voting the opposite. In other words, every state of this union is a shade of purple. And our framers envisioned that as the American creed. To your point, we were not born out of a theocratic system or a partisan system, you know, or an aristocratic system in, you know, relation to the king. We were born out of a system of ideas and not partisan identity. And so I would like, you know, your listeners in South Dakota, which, you know, I've gotten to know as well as the New York City subway system, the towns and cities across the state, not like you, but still pretty good. You know, South Dakota is not a red state. New York is not a blue state. They're all purple states because when you add the voters together in the hundreds of thousands who are still voting for a Republican in New York, that end product is a medley of view, of race, of, you know, ethnic origin. And we forget that. And on July 4th of all days, it's the day to remember we are all shades of purple, or red, white, and blue.
The first episode of season two of Breaking Bread with Alexander premieres on Independence Day. You can find it online at Bloomberg Originals and PBS's The Open Mind starting tomorrow. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. On Monday, the Supreme Court made a major ruling on presidential immunity. The 6-3 decision said that former President Donald Trump is immune from prosecution for, quote, official acts. Lisa Hager is an associate professor of political science at South Dakota State University and is with us now via Zoom with some analysis. Professor Hager, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So I've been thinking back a lot, and two thoughts have come to my mind. One, I just want to come in your class as a freshman and say, explain this to me. So I'm so glad that you're here today to do that, because my head hurts with all the analysis, and I rely on you to distill it for me and for our listeners. And also, I think back to before Donald Trump took office in 2016 and how some of his advisors then were saying, there is far more power for an American president than has been tested. And I remember wondering at the time what they meant, and now I'm wondering if this is what they meant. So open the classroom door for this political science or constitutional law freshman and help me understand what just happened.
Yeah, for sure. No, the one thing I will say in response to both of your comments is I think a presidential immunity was usually maybe a half day, possibly an entire day when I started teaching my government powers constitutional law class, and it is quickly evolving. And the Trump presidency has played a big role in that. Same thing with impeachment. That used to be a day. Now it's, you know, an entire unit. So the one good thing is it, you know, means that there's always new questions. What we're talking about is relevant and whatnot, but gets to that second comment where there's a lot of untested powers of the president. And we're seeing that with President Trump and I'm sure many other presidents in the future.
So when the U.S. Supreme Court starts looking at these things, what are they referencing? They're referencing the text of the U.S. Constitution, the arguments of the attorneys in front of them. What else are they putting into how they look at this, these individual questions of law?
Yeah, so a lot of times they're looking, like you said, at the text of the Constitution. And yeah, there's definitely the arguments that both sides are making, which are typically also grounded in the text of the Constitution, the framing of the Constitution. So trying to look at what the framers' intentions were with a lot of these different kinds of things. And I will say as a sidebar on all of that, you know, when we're looking at Article 2 of the Constitution, where everything about the presidency is, you know, I assign that to my students and it's relatively short. And then we start looking at Article 1 when we're talking about Congress, and a lot of things are spelled out. And so that's a lot of times where there's some surprise and why I say there's also a lot of questions and why we're in the situations that we're in. And so going back to my previous point, you know, sometimes they're looking at relevant case precedent to the best of their ability. So with this particular decision that was handed down on Monday, we're looking at things relating to the president, you know, having immunity in civil cases, both over official acts, but also anything that would be private in nature. So not always the most relevant, but it's the closest that we really have to go off of. And sometimes there's arguments about Congress, but that's a hard argument to make. For instance, immunity for members of Congress, because there's actually, you know, quite a bit devoted to Congress and the Constitution and more on that than what we see with the president in Article 2.
Yeah. What do you think happens next? Especially what I'm curious about is what you think the next relevant questions are that you're looking forward to say, well, we're going to be talking about this next, and then we're going to be talking about this. What doors have opened here?
Yeah, I think the biggest door that got opened is this question of exactly what is an official versus an unofficial act. And I think the Supreme Court starts to answer that question to a certain extent in the Trump v. United States case. If you read it, not that I'm expecting most anyone to have read it thoroughly at this point, I'm planning on assigning it to my students and we'll have quite a bit of time to dive into it. But I think that's really going to be the biggest question, especially when we start looking at some of these cases that Trump is currently involved with. So things like the, you know, hush money case, for instance, the retention of classified documents, you know, all of those things are going to be recasted. They're going to be delayed because of this particular decision. And so we need to be looking at, you know, how lower courts actually start determining what is an official and unofficial act. And my gut reaction is we'll probably see some things actually continuing to reach the Supreme Court on this to get a more definitive answer. Although I think the Supreme Court does a pretty good job of signaling that quite a bit is considered an official act. So we'll just kind of have to see what the lower courts do. I would say that's probably the biggest thing at this point with this particular case.
So one of the concerns of regardless of which one of these, you know, epic presidencies you're supportive of, or maybe you're disgusted with all of them, but one of the things that's really concerned South Dakotans is just how often something feels like a political attack. And then people are also concerned, you know, you don't want impeachment every other day because you're just trying to slow down the works, for example. That's huge hyperbole, but you see what I'm getting at there. But you also cannot imagine in this country a president, the one that is in the White House now, Joe Biden, or the one that might be there in the future, whoever that is, just having the ability to say, well, look what we can do now. Americans don't like, you know, the president is not above the law. Did the Supreme Court just decide that the president is above the law?
I would probably say no. I can see why some people have that interpretation, given some of the things that get said in terms of if we're really kind of looking at when the president would be assumed to mostly have immunity and the discussion of, well, you know, they can move forward with a criminal prosecution if it would pose no dangers of intrusion on the authority and functions of the executive branch, and what that means in terms of Congress really not having a lot of opportunity to put any really regulations in place with respect to the presidency, because that could be a separation of powers violation. And so there are a lot of folks who start to feel like, well, then how do we rein in presidents? And I think that's where we get ourselves to these Supreme Court cases where they really have to tell us what the bounds of Article 2 are. And they somewhat did that here, but not as clearly as I think some folks would like. And so I think that is where we get that tendency to run to the extremes of, well, it seems like, you know, so much would be allowed. But I think they're also trying to be restrained in the sense that, like, we do have impeachment, and that's probably one of the better ways for dealing with any sorts of issues with the president.
Yeah.
Not so much the civil justice system or the criminal justice system.
And at the risk of sounding monumentally naive about the American political process, I do feel like it's worth saying that we're actually in charge of it. In a democracy, that we can amend the Constitution and that we can send people to make the laws that represent what we want. Like, we have a lot of power. I know that's complicated and it's really hard to, you know, to address some of these things, but it's not like it's all happening to us. We're participating in this democracy still. And I think that's worth saying as we head into the 4th of July.
Yeah, for sure. And I know that the president is the most significant political figure that we have in the United States. But I think especially since it's an election year, and obviously we have very polarizing candidates, it's one of those things where people just get really wrapped up in who is the president and assumes that everything they do or say they're going to do will happen, where it's like, we do have Congress. Granted, sometimes they're not the most effective at making legislation. But we do have Congress, we do have the Supreme Court. Yes, I know that that's, you know, appointed by the president. You know, we have all these.
I'm sorry, I have to jump in, but your point is well taken. We're up against our time post for the day, Lisa Hager. Thank you so much. We'll definitely have this conversation in the future. More in the Moment up next on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We enter the holiday weekend with an SDPB summer tradition, Summer with a Symphony. Today, Mozart's Symphony No. 9. It's one of the composer's early symphonies, and this performance was recorded live in the Washington Pavilion Great Hall in January. The orchestra here is under the direction of Maestro Delta David Geyer. Thank you.
Thank you.
That is Mozart's Symphony No. 29, recorded live and performed by the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra under the direction of Maestro Delta David Geyer. The January 20th concert was called Mozart and More. We'll have more next week when we bring you Vivaldi's Oboe Concerto in C Major and Haydn's Symphony No. 59 in A Major, otherwise known as the Fire Symphony. That is our show for today. We hope that it served you. On Mondays in the Moment, jump ahead a bit. We've been talking a lot about the U.S. economy lately with a focus on inflation. Wealth advisor and financial therapist Rick Kaler takes the topic forward by exploring the intersection between economic perception and economic reality. In the Moment is produced by Ellen Kester and Ari Youngeman. Our executive producer is Kara Hetland. Our videographer is Jordan Henderson, and our engineer is Colton Nicholson. From all of us at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh, asking you to be safe this holiday weekend, watch the weather, slow down in the construction zones, celebrate America responsibly. And we thank you for listening.